Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. This episode is part of a special mini-series produced in collaboration with Bloomberg Businessweek, bringing you sustainable finance and leadership for a changing world. I'll be hearing from some of the thought leaders speaking at the Bloomberg Businessweek Good Business Festival held at the Conduit on topics including clean air, the future of energy, reimagining cities, and sustainable supply chains.
I do believe that circular economy has profoundly positive prospects, but the question is, there is a race against time.
My guest today is Richard Pearl, Chief Administrative Officer of TerraCycle, a high-impact, award-winning, profitable and growing international waste solutions company which operates in over 20 countries. For 35 years, Richard has been involved in diverse businesses from clean energy development, carbon credits, clean tech advisory, real estate, media, natural products, retail and home finishing, generally in the role of an advisor or board member. He attended college, law school, and business schools at Columbia University, where I also taught. So it's delightful to welcome you here today. Welcome.
Thank you, Paul. I'm really happy to be here.
When did you know that you wanted to forge a career with green or sustainability at its core?
My senior year in college, I had a course that talked about the interrelationship of global problems, the need for comprehensive global solutions, and the fact that if we solved these related problems of war and hunger, but didn't solve the environment, my generation might not see grandchildren, got me to get that that's where I wanted and needed to put my efforts.
And when did you decide to focus on waste as a particular core problem amongst all the broad and interrelated sustainability problems?
In October of 2007, I met the CEO and founder of TerraCycle, then 5 years old, Tom Zaki, and he was focused on these issues, a company I'd taken public here in London on the AIM Exchange, a clean energy company, so that was my most recent prior focus. Got a tender offer, and Tom asked if I could help him build TerraCycle. I switched because I believed in Tom, and the cause was as good as any.
So at this year's World Economic Forum, TerraCycle unveiled a global shopping and reuse system called Loop. Tell us a little bit more about Loop and what it does and why it matters.
Every time someone buys a consumer product these days, it comes in a package. You want to buy the content, but you end up owning the package. And for the most part, that package becomes waste after a single use. And the product itself, a pen maybe a month, a candy wrapper after a moment. And that's disposability, linear economy, single use. And it's really a historical anomaly and atrocity in our view. There used to be durability. Think of the milkman. Loop is the restoration of durability, the beginning of the end of disposability, and hopefully beginning soon, well, it will begin soon, but hopefully the beginning where durability becomes the norm and disposability the exception. So it's basically enabling major brands, and we have many of the world's largest brands, and major retailers, many of the world's major retailers, joining forces to provide a durable package that can be sold to a consumer, used, returned for cleaning by Loop, then the clean package returned to the manufacturer, the brand, for refilling and going to another consumer. The consumer gets a much more expensive package on which they pay a deposit, which comes back later. It's a more durable package, a more luxurious package, a more functional package, just like the milk bottle versus a plastic bottle. And what happens here is you now can have, and the goal and objective is, 100 cycles of use, and then 100% recyclable because there's value in the material, all protected by a deposit. So the consumer is basically just paying for content after they've put down the deposit.
So a practical example, I like my shampoo, and instead of every time I buy my shampoo, I get a little piece of single-use plastic that is the receptacle for my shampoo, and then I discard. I have a refillable shampoo bottle, higher quality, a better look and feel that I continue, I use and then I send back and I continue to get that shampoo in that reusable bottle that may have been used by another consumer. Is that it?
Precisely.
So what are the challenges in executing that? Because I think intuitively that sounds like a remarkably good idea. Everybody wins, sustainability is advanced, and in principle, brands should save money over time. Tell us about the real world. Be an entrepreneur for a moment. Tell us about what the difficulties are in actually getting this off the ground.
For a moment. I think the first thing to say is you spoke about it. The question is over time. In the beginning, you're not going to have scale. The key is to get to scale quickly because the cost to clean, say, 1,000 units is very different than cleaning 100,000 units, say, in a day. And so as you're getting started, you're not going to use high-speed, expensive facilities with optical sorting. But in a couple of years, that's the goal. Tesco kicks in here in the UK in January, February. Carrefour kicks in November in France this year. We have Walgreens and Kroger in the States. Kroger may not be known here in the UK, but it is the largest grocer in the world, $115 billion of turnover. And when you think of the number of packages that will now be available to people, same product, so you like your shampoo, and same retailer, you shop where you want to shop, the difference is the package. The brands do not have a risk in the package because the consumer puts down a deposit. If the consumer chooses to keep the package or loses it, the brand gets the deposit back, and there's different models for how that works. The retailers like it because it gives the consumer an incentive to go back into the store because they'll give them a break. And what do they want? Foot traffic. So I think it really creates a nice circular economy synergy across the board. It's just scaling. To get from zero, where there is no washing, it was disrupted by disposability in the 50s. And now restoring washing, getting it to scale in logistical systems so you have enough scale where from every perspective, carbon, cleaning, efficiency, the investment into cleaning facilities across the board, that's going to take a transition time.
So let me try and understand the economics for a moment. I walk into the aisle at Tesco's and I see my favorite shampoo and it's in a Loop branded piece of packaging. And I have to then say, my shampoo usually costs me £5, but I will now pay a pound deposit for the packaging, for the bottle that it's in. I take it home, I use it, and then I take it out my shower next time I go to Tesco's, and I bring it back to Tesco's. And when I bring it back, when I normally buy the shampoo for £5, am I then buying it for £4.50 because I brought back the packaging, or am I still just paying £5?
Well, remember the first time you didn't pay £5, you paid £6 because you put down.
Correct.
So you're going to keep paying £5 at least for some time. The point is you put down a deposit, and if you bring back a package, then you get to take a package out for free. Most likely you will not be bringing a single package at a time, but multiple packages at a time, and the check-in system will not, you may deliver it to Tesco, but the check-in will actually be done by Loop because Tesco doesn't want to get involved in the check-in of this and that and this and that. But they will be happy to accept your bag back and even give you an incentive on your shopping trip there because you've done so. But the actual checking in of the facilities and telling them how much deposit to restore will be done by Loop. And again, when you see that shampoo, it's not a Loop package. It is a Loop accepted package produced by the brand that made that shampoo.
But do I, over time, for the risk of putting out my initial deposit, in order to, I pay a little bit more, but I'm a firmly committed, sustainable, circular economy guy or gal. After a while, if it's circular, do I pay less for the product that's in the package because I put out a deposit for the first purchase?
Well, you'll get your deposit back anytime you want. So the point is that you're ultimately just paying, you have a deposit storing for you, which comes back to you, and you're buying content as if you were buying content that was disposable, but without the disposable package. Is there ultimately a savings? Yeah. We hope so, we plan so, but it's too far ahead to say that that's in the system. Logically, we should get there at scale. The more important point is the content should be the same as cost should be the same as if you buy it in a disposable package, but you have the benefit of a more luxurious functional package. Think of all the functionality. May I give an example? For example, right now we have launched ice cream with Häagen-Dazs in a durable container that keeps the ice cream cold for 7 hours at room temperature, which is not just a consumer convenience for your summer picnic. What's beautiful is it's a major carbon savings because it can now be delivered locally in a refrigerated truck rather than in a super frozen one. Now expand your imagination around the world in all the hot places during summertime, which varies, and all those super frozen trucks that can now be replaced by refrigerated. And that's just because there's a little air section between the exterior part and the interior part, and it also makes enjoyment of the ice cream better. So the future of packaging, when a brand can now put its intelligence into it because they're not making it as cheap as possible as a cost of goods sold, but rather as an asset that will come back to them, they keep it on their balance sheet, amortize it over time, and again, see profit from it. But again, the cost of cleaning needs to come out also of that savings. And as cleaning gets fast, And to scale, there will be, we project nice net savings that will also be passed on to the consumer. One more interesting thing that would help, if you love that shampoo so much, whatever brand it is, you can ask for automatic reorder. And they can state, if you actually go to automatic reorder, we don't need to market to you anymore. We'll build in an incentive to you to stay with us, so that the price will come down if that's what you want every time your bottle is empty. And indeed, with smart packaging, in time, it'll be easy for, if you turn it on, for the package to say your bottle's almost empty. Would you like a new one to come so that you don't even have to go back to the store? It'll just come to you, and that's all enabled by a smart system.
It strikes me that packaging is such an enormous source of waste and pollution, such an extraordinary, unnecessary cost, all in the name of convenience. And if we had infinite resources and a boundless planet, this may be something that was in principle justifiable. We have neither of those things, and therefore it's not. So therefore, shouldn't we all as citizens be agitating for a pretty draconian tax to be levied against single-use plastics, non-recyclable packaging, so that, in fact, what you're trying to do is not something that consumers should be having to pay more for in the form of a deposit. It should be the adverse punishment of companies who don't, in fact, develop and sell their products in recyclable packaging.
I can't disagree with you in principle. In practice, when EPR, Extended Producer Responsibility schemes have been put forth, they have often met significant resistance that has caused the politicians to either not proceed with them, say in the US, or to water them down. And again, even those that exist, such as the Douala system in Germany, they don't fund authentic recycling of most plastics and cheap packaging. They fund incinerators. And waste to energy is modestly better from a life cycle analysis than landfill. So I think that in theory, I totally agree. But I think that we can create a market solution here, and that's what we at Loop are relying on to get to the same goal. And I think that people will actually, I think people sense the spiritual breach of getting the content they want and then needing to throw away. They just don't have a choice yet. Our hope is that it's there. Now, for many countries where the plastic is actually ending up in the ocean rather than in a landfill or an incinerator, those are also the same countries where they're not going to have the money for a deposit. So we're going to need some sort of system to enable, say, on a telephone, to be able to give a microcredit, which is a great sense of return so that people can have the credit and be able to not have to come out of pocket for the deposit. I think we need to prove the system first in developed markets, which is why we're starting there. But the real goal is to make this universal and bring it to scale and then bring it to places where so much of the plastic and disposable plastic is heading into the oceans.
I mean, I'm obviously a fan, and I think this is a remarkably important company, and I think it's essential that it wins. And I know that you have been one of the companies that have been on the Conduit Connect platform, which is a platform here at the Conduit designed to showcase some of the most innovative companies in the world and try to crowd in a whole bunch of different support for them. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
I can, but I want to first make one interesting piece. If Loop fails, and we have no intention of that, we've got the world's largest brands, the world's largest retailers, we're just getting started, and we have high confidence that it's an empirical necessity. But if we fail, someone else will do it. As you put it, disposability should be a historical anomaly that people are going to look back and say, how could they? And the point is, once people have a choice, I think the move to durability will be there. And if we're successful, there will be competition. And there should be. The world's a big place and we need that. But mostly what I want to say is I do believe that durability will be here and that the economics, having studied them for some great time now, are inherently good for everyone but the landfills. That said, of course, it does take some capital to get there. First of all, before we get to Conduit Connect, just Conduit Club, having been around, what you're doing here to bring in the intelligence of finance in London with the values of impact, and that as you come through here, that every conversation is about one level or another of impact and how we use capital to get there, and that full degree of intentionality is not only in the conversations, but in the extended community, is creating a grounding here that I hope you take globally, because the desire is there and it's very sophisticated and visceral. You can feel it. Conduit Connect is a vehicle that you have created to enable companies such as Loop to reach that community, both to create ideas, because so many things that will happen within Loop as it grows are going to happen on the side. People coming up with ways to make bottle caps measure contents and things related to IoT relating to packaging to create things that people can turn on or off, but that will create consumer convenience, et cetera. That's going to happen outside, and so there's a lot of innovation that will come around knowing ideas that are coming. But we are raising some capital for Loop in the UK. We're not doing that in all markets, but we are in the UK, and as we begin that process, we've met with people we would love to have involved and who want to be involved here through Conduit Connect, and it's been an extraordinary service, and we're grateful to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your advice. You've been on, you've walked a long road on the fight for sustainable businesses, and you've been an innovator in that front for a long time. And in the Conduit community, there are a set of people who are starting up their own businesses, trying to marry both purpose with profit. So give some kind of advice with the benefit of wisdom and experience as to that generation of entrepreneurs who are just starting out.
So thank you for the recognition. And with humility, I will do my best to reply. That's a big question. I think the first thing is be authentic to your mission. Look at what really needs to be done. And don't just think it through. Feel it through. Your intuition is perhaps the best intelligence you have as an entrepreneur. Sense where the need is and be market savvy and talk. You have to decide if you want to innovate something new or something new within existing players. Loop is engaging the world's largest brands and the world's largest retailers, and so people can buy their same favorite products. The changes in the packaging and getting them to work together. It's a different challenge. Many of the best new ideas are completely revolutionary, but we are seeing, obviously, the trend toward the sharing economy. We're just making packaging as a service and trying to do it right. But what I'm saying is, don't forget that the big players will be dinosaurs if you don't give them innovation, and they're hungry and desperate for it. And make sure your financials make sense, okay? Look at the incentives for all the different players and don't go with blinders, but also don't go with your mind open and your heart closed. Those are the two key pieces. If your heart is open, you will begin to see pathways that will come through. Don't just think it through, sense it through, and be in dialogue with great people.
So you've been featured today in our Good Business Festival here at The Conduit, together with Bloomberg Business Week. Tell us something either on the panel that you're on or that you heard over the course of the day that was interesting or surprising or inspiring to you.
I think the point to state is that I heard a quote early this morning that was given from a book called The Uninhabitable Earth. And what it basically said is that people seem to be willing to accept the end of life on the planet easier than they're willing to accept the end of capitalism. I mean, to me, that was insane, but also true. People who, in my country, who voted for the current administration, it's often against their interest. They've given up their health care. They've given up farm subsidies. And these are farmers who think they're doing better because they're preserving a system that, frankly, isn't in their interests, their personal interests. But a lot of ideology is a scary thing, and so is false news. And I think that quote really hurt me. It was painful to me, but true. I do believe, on the other hand, that the progress that has been made over the years that was pointed out in the energy panel this morning to make renewable energy now the best game in town in many, many areas, not all, and how that is going to bring down the costs of batteries for vehicles so that electric vehicles can be such a part of the future and other changes, that it makes the possibilities of getting to the critical carbon reductions in the coming years viable. That doesn't mean there's not more work to do. It means there's more work to do and more investment. But there is a pathway, as we see many steps being taken back, particularly by the U.S. government, but perhaps others as well.
You are an essential part of the circular economy. And the circular economy is often contrasted with the linear economy, and you speak eloquently about that. Tell us a little bit about how optimistic you are about the world moving from a linear economy to a circular economy and what some of the challenges are in that transition.
So one, I am optimistic. Two, I'm methodologically optimistic, because if you don't give life to a, if you don't presume it's yes, you don't give life to the possibility. Thirdly, I learned back when I was first an activist that when the ordinary behavior of a species becomes counterproductive, it destroys itself unless it's intelligent enough to adapt. So I think that there is intelligence that is finding its way seeping through despite our seriously stupid practices. Fourth, there is enormous amount of innovation. The circular economy concept wasn't on the map 5-6 years ago. Maybe Ellen MacArthur Foundation had funded the Grand McKinsey study, but it was just going on then. And now there's trillions of dollars, not just the STDs, which are also relatively new, but going specifically to circular economy. And I believe that it's like one of those no-brainers that everybody's saying, well, how do I do it? And how do I do it? And what's going to happen is the old ways will have resistance, because there are people making decisions to say, but what happens to me? I will be disrupted. But I think it'll happen despite them. And the goal is not to leave people behind, as I believe it was Laurie today spoke and said, do not leave people behind, because if you leave too many people behind, the changes you want cannot occur. So we need to be allies and train people, but there's a place in the circular economy. There's jobs, washing, cleaning, sorting, even in places where there isn't automation. So my basic feeling is I am hopeful and methodologically hopeful, and I do believe that circular economy has profoundly positive prospects, but the question is, there is a race against time. But I don't believe it's 11:59 on the clock either. I think nature is resilient, and will of people is a strong and a powerful force.
Richard Pearl, for everything that you've done, both in your past and for helping to birth and incubate and grow Loop, we are enormously grateful and we are rooting for you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Paul. It's really great to be here and to be with you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations, produced in partnership with Bloomberg Business Week. Feel feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. For more information on The Conduit and our community of change makers, please visit theconduit.com. To learn more about Bloomberg Businessweek, please visit businessweek.com.